You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to the Parish Council. This is the podcast from the Rocking Vicar. I'm Magnus Shaw, and he took it all too far, but boy, could he play guitar. It's our friend Terence de Cajon.
Ah, Boa Carway. Pussy, pussy. Hello, Magnus Shaw.
Hello.
How on earth are
you? Yeah, very good indeed. Very good. Thank you very much. So looking forward to the end of the deluge, which I think is due in the next 24 hours, isn't it?
So they tell us, just in time for the Olympic Games, of which, of course, you'll be enthralled.
Well,
over the next few weeks.
Well, I probably won't be enthralled, but I don't want it to rain all over the damn thing. You know, that would be rather churlish of me. And
now, the last few weeks, you've started the podcast off in a really downbeat manner by introducing a theme of death.
Yes, yes. Well, I'm trying to stick with it because this is all coming from a book I'm reading at the moment. And
it's taking you a long time to get through this book.
I'm dipping into it. Yeah, yeah. But I would just ask you, what do you think Joss is in terms of the Chinese culture? What is Joss?
Joss, what, J-O-S-S?
Yes, as in stone, yes, yeah.
Oh, yeah, as in stone. Oh, of course, yes. Incense-related in some way?
Yeah, you'd think so, wouldn't you? I think that's the Indian definition of Joss. This is bundles of up to 50 million... now, it doesn't say the denomination. What's the denomination in China? The dong, is it? No, that's Thailand, isn't it?
I have no insight. I can't help you here with the currency.
No, well, okay, 50 million of whatever the Chinese currency is. Somebody will tell us, I'm sure. They're bundles of up to 50 million of them, which are burnt at a funeral to guard the deceased against evil and to attract the blessing of dead ancestors. So can you imagine that? We don't know how many... whatever's the right
exchange rate is. It could be 50 pence, it could be 50 billion pounds.
Yeah, I'm guessing it's more significant value than that. But imagine burning money at a funeral in this country. That would be quite curious, wouldn't it? And this seems to be quite a lot of money. Anyway, that's what Joss is.
Well, I see. Well, last week you had us with drive-by coffins and now it's burning money at funerals. Listen, Magnus, you're quite the world traveller.
Well...
go on, yes.
Well, no, this is often levelled at me that I spend more time abroad than is strictly necessary. Yes. But
and therefore, I'm fairly sure that you're well on top of the need that one has to do in the UK to renew your passport every 10 years if you're an adult.
Oh, yeah, yeah, of course, yeah.
And this crept up on me this week. I just happened to think, oh, I'll probably be going somewhere or other in September. Oh, gosh, my passport. And I had a look, and it runs out in August 2012. So I thought, oh, my goodness me, I'd better get it renewed.
Yeah.
First of all, much to my surprise, when you go onto the DirectGov website to establish what you've got to do, I was expecting, again, I know I'm so naive, I was expecting to pay about 20 quid. It's yeah, exactly. Yeah. £77.50 for the standard service. If you're in a hurry, £112.50 for the 1 week service, so-called fast track service. If you want the 1 day premium service, £129.50.
It just sort of makes you wonder why there has to be a premium service. It seems like if they can get it done in that time, then just get it done in that time and tell you how much it's going to cost. Why do they sort of dangle a first class service, which is probably what you need, in front of you? You know,
exactly. Yes. Now, but the thing that absolutely struck me is you then click on completed the application for whatever, and then it tells you what you need to enclose with your passport application, and of course you need to update your photograph.
Yeah,
and this is where it all comes to pass, because you would think that you just pop into one of those photo booths, sit there, click, you know, put the coins in, click, get your photos, send them off. Oh no, life has changed considerably. There's about 30 bullet points that you have to be aware of now, before you actually even put your bottom on the stool in the booth. First of all, it advises you, the photographs you supply must show you with, and I'm quoting, show you with a neutral expression and your mouth closed. Open brackets, no grinning, no frowning, or raised eyebrows.
God forbid Roger Moore should ever get his passport.
They're going to be in colour, not black and white. They're going to be identical, so you don't dare raise an eyebrow between one and the other, or you've had it. They're going to be taken within the last month. They've got to be so many millimetres high, so many millimetres wide. They're going to be taken against a plain cream or plain light grey background. Mustn't show you with red eye. So obviously you mustn't have had a hard night out on the town the day before. They've got to be free from shadows. Be taken with your eyes open and clearly visible. No sunglasses, no tinted glasses, no hair across your eyes. Mm-hmm. Since I read about that, a friend of mine told me that their passport photos were sent back, their wife's passport photos sent back, because she has a fringe. And they wrote back saying, you need to brush your fringe back in order for your photo to be accepted. Yeah. True story. True story. Be taken with nothing covering your face. You should make sure that nothing covers the outline of your eyes, nose, or mouth. So any outlaw with that sort of handkerchief, like in the Wild West, they wouldn't get a passport.
To be fair, I was guessing that they didn't allow a large handkerchief tied across the face on a passport photo. I don't think that's a new stipulation there.
They do help by making that clear. And then right at the end, there's this marvellous last bit. So you think, okay, I've got all that. I've got that in my mind. I'm going to go and get my photos now. And then it says, the photos must be a close-up of your head and shoulders with a recommended head height, the distance between the bottom of your chin and the crown of your head, between 29 and 34 millimetres. So you actually have to take a ruler in with you now.
No, but hold on. How would you adjust that? What if the distance between your chin and the top of your head is 50 millimetres? How do you adjust that for your passport photo?
Absolutely stuck. You either have to go for quite major surgery or you don't travel. Actually, so that'd be a close-up of your head and shoulders with a recommended head height, the distance between the bottom of your chin and the crown of your head, between 29 and 34 millimetres.
In those photo me booths, there will now be a large industrial vice that you can place your head in to adjust the measurements of the distance from your chin to the top of your head. You can see there are good security reasons for all of this, but it does sort of tip towards this British obsession that we've talked about with the rules and regulations. We love a set of rules, don't we, in Britain? We just love it.
Oh, we love it. You can actually almost feel the relish with which a civil servant has sat there and laced in all these bullet points, and they probably disappointed that they couldn't think of more. There's about 20 or 30 of them. Instead of where 5 years ago you would just thought, well, I'll just go and get my photo taken. Yeah. I know it's just going to be a true likeness of me. I'll just go and sit in a photo booth. You're now confronted in a bureaucratic nightmare before you can actually get in.
And then I noticed somebody on Twitter on this subject saying that it was the 5 attempts to get a photo of their baby. Without grinning. Yeah, I mean, babies either cry or grin, don't they? There's only two things that they do, and neither of those are going to be acceptable. Incredible.
I think you're right. Yes, it was someone tweeting me saying that they tried to get a passport photo of a baby approved. I've just pulled it up. Yes, that they succeeded only after multiple attempts.
I know, and it's, what is it, £6 a go in the booth or something, isn't it?
Is it really? Oh my God, I've got all that come. Oh, okay. But you, of course, would always have your passport fully up to date at all times and would never have attempted to travel.
Well, you'd think, wouldn't you? But here's the thing. Yeah. They're 10-year documents, aren't they?
So, yeah, 10 years.
By the time you hit the fifth or the sixth year, you've kind of got into a sense of complacency, haven't you? You know, I've got my travel documents. I'm good to go. So certainly when the 10th year rolls round, you've completely forgotten about the notion of it expiring or anything. You know, you just reach in the desk drawer and get your passport on the night of your journey, don't you? Make sure I've got my passport, definitely got my passport done. So this is what I did once, and dutifully set off to Manchester Airport and arrived at the desk rather late, actually, because I'd been waylaid in terrible traffic. And they were saying, come on, you're in the desk, about to close. And it was all a big flap and panic. And I handed all my documents over. Right. opened my passport and said, this expired 2 weeks ago, sir.
Oh, my
God. Yeah. I said, oh, my God, what can I do? And they said, well, it's no problem with us. They said, yeah, we'll let you travel. We don't mind you going away. You know, your passport is, you know, for acceptance into the destination, really, technically.
Yeah.
And they said, what we can do is we can phone Mykonos Airport, see if they'll accept you because it's only 2 weeks out of date. And sometimes they will. And so I stood there with my fingers crossed for 5 or 10 minutes, and they came back and said, no, they're not having it. They're just not having it.
Oh, no. So you couldn't go?
Well, I was with my wife, and her passport was in order. So I said, go. So she went to Mykonos. So I got the train back. left the car for her return. I got the train.
Yeah.
I got the train back with my tail between my legs. Yeah, it was.
When you didn't get it done, you didn't get a quickly renewed passport, or you just sat out the holiday at home.
Well, you know what I mean. I got home and made all the appropriate calls and everything. And by the time I'd got a train to Liverpool, sat in the office there to get a reissued passport with all the documents and everything. You know, we were only going for a week. I might have got out there for the two remaining days or something.
So it just wasn't worth it.
Yeah, and of course I didn't have a ticket.
I only had a ticket for that flight,
that one flight anyway. So.
Abject disaster. There's a warning to all of us, isn't it? Keep a note of it when your passport expires.
The only sucker I could take from the whole thing was when I did get back home, there was a message on my answer. This is back in the days of the answering machines. A message on my answering machine asking me if I was available to do an absolute rake of well-paid work. So, which I would have got too late had I gone to Greece. So, you know, swings and roundabouts, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but let that be a lesson. You know, always look at that flipping date on your passport. You know,
absolutely. Okay. Yeah. We love you, Poland! That's what Madonna shouted out during the week at her gig. Unfortunately, the gig was in Hyde Park, London, when she shouted out, "We love you, Poland." So that got that gig off to a less than memorable start. And that really set the tone for really a long weekend of pretty grim gigs, particularly for the concert goers. At Hyde Park in London, but they possibly would have been better off in Poland, quite frankly.
this has happened quite a few times, hasn't it, where a major artist has come on, excluding Spinal Tap, has come on and announced how pleased they are to be in the wrong place. So I don't think this is the first time, is it? Somebody appearing at Glastonbury, I'm trying to think who it was who came on and said, London crowds are the best crowds in the world, thinking that they'd so they clearly landed at Exeter Airport, maybe, and been helicoptered to Glastonbury and imagined that, you know, we must be somewhere near London, you know. I can't think who that was now. Certainly somebody not resident in the UK, but that's not the first time that's happened.
In the wonderful and iconic Todd Rundgren in his live album Back to the Bars, which is as I say a live album, he deliberately mistakes where he is and gets the crowd going by querying where he is on this extensive tour. So yes, Madonna during the week, friends of mine were at the gig. They actually left early because they said that, first of all, to no surprise to anybody who's been following the news over the last week or so of the Hyde Park extravaganzas, that the sound level was really poor. It was very low. There was still residual mud. Madonna, it appeared, didn't engage at all with the audience. She played loads of new stuff at great length. And I was just seeing my Twitter feed and texts and so on, people saying, Madonna, we're coming home. It's awful. It's terrible.
Wow.
Just before that was Paul Simon on Sunday. And there again, the feedback was that the sound level was too low. But of course, the piece de resistance was the opening of this trinity, which was Bruce Springsteen, who was in Hyde Park on Saturday night. And as we all know now, had the plug pulled from his set because he'd overrun the curfew, which led to his guitarist, Steve Van Zandt, saying on Twitter, one of the great gigs ever in my opinion, but seriously, when did England become a police state? So we've making sure we've become a police state because the organisers of this gig didn't allow Paul McCartney and Bruce to finish their rendition of Twist and Shout.
Yeah, well, you know, memo to Steve Van Zandt, you know, calm down. It's, we don't actually live in a police state. But the rock stars, as you pointed out, when we were talking about John Lydon the other week, rock stars aren't used to being told no, are they? I think that's the problem. And certainly not in such a blunt way as having the plug pulled on them. I'm not sure when the last time the E Street Band were, you know, involuntarily switched off, but it can't have been terribly recently. And I guess they don't take too kindly to that. Yeah, I suppose if you overrun, you know, that's the threat that's hanging over you, that everything might be switched off. I've never known it happen. I've certainly known events to overrun. I think generally the promoters take their lives in their hands, don't they, and say, well, you know, I'm not going to be, have the finger pointed at me as the guy who, you know, axed Oasis or whoever it might be, the Floyd or whoever. So I'll just let it overrun and see what happens. And I guess some promoters have dipped in their pockets and paid the fine in order for the show to run to its conclusion. But, yeah, I guess that can happen. Rock stars and rock concerts tend to get underway late, don't they? It seems to be a tradition, I think.
They do, but I think in these particular instances, I don't even think there's so much that there's a fine in place. It's just that Live Nation, who are the promoters, have had to go through quite a number of hoops with the local authority, Westminster Council, in order to retain the licences to be able to stage these concerts in Hyde Park. Certainly the number that they're going to be able to run from next year has dropped. Mm. And certainly the noise levels, the decibel levels, if you like, has also been reduced in recent years. And the licence for them was granted on very strict noise restrictions. And of course, we mustn't forget traffic plans, because it also has to be judged about what transport is in place to get people away from the gig and in time to get back home before, you know, the last transport has finished, which finishes remarkably early, considering that London is the capital city. Yeah. You know, you're quite often quite stuffed if you want to try and get a train out of Waterloo much after 11 o'clock. Yes. You'd think, well, the evening's just beginning. It's all over for the railway network. Yeah. But the license was given on the basis that Bruce could play. They had to be over by 10:30. The whole thing had to be switched to 10:30. So Bruce was engaged to play from 7 o'clock to 10:15. Now he came on 30 minutes, up to 30 minutes. Some say 20 minutes. Some say 30 minutes late. And so, bearing in mind he should have finished at 10:15, and he knew this, the plug was actually pulled at 10:38, 8 minutes over the curfew. So they had stretched it as far as they could go, and apparently the sort of vibe coming back from on stage was that Twist and Shout wasn't the end of it. Paul and Bruce were so into it, it seemed that they were just about ready to go, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then into something else. Yeah. So, you know, the question remains, you know, where do you draw the line?
Well,
considered a damp squib, but as I mentioned in a piece I've written this week in the column, you know, one does have to consider that Hyde Park is, like it or not, actually in a residential area. You've got Mayfair within 100 yards one side and the Bayswater Road the other side, where people will be trying to get young children to sleep.
Yeah, and what that says to me really is, are these things taking place in the right venue? If to play in Hyde Park, you have to be very, very quiet and finish at what would seem to be a very un-rock and roll hour. And you know, the audience area is liable to turning into the Somme if it so much as drizzles. Then have you really picked the right spot for your gig, to be perfectly honest? If this was all at the O2, yeah, there would be a designated endpoint, but it wouldn't matter if it carried on, because, you know, it's a self-contained venue right out on that peninsula there in the Thames. You're not going to be keeping anybody awake, and it's got a roof on it as well. So is Hyde Park the right place for gigs? That seems to be the problem.
It's entirely the wrong place, in my view, and it's a view that I talk about at further length, as I say, in the column. I first trod onto the turf of Hyde Park to see a musical gig in, I was still at school, in 1971, and the sound even back then was terrible. And nothing has improved it ever since, because, as you rightly say, it's not a natural place to have music play. You've got traffic coming down two sides. You've got open fields across the other two sides, essentially, and the only kind of surround that in any way would contain the music is delivered by trees, which aren't, you know, designed really for that purpose. So it's an entirely silly place, really, to hold music. And, of course, it's really badly placed because there's no mainline railway network nearby.
No.
There's buses and tubes. But, you know, there were, I think, 38,000 people there for the Springsteen gig. And to get that sort of number of people in and out sensibly, you know, you do really need a great transport system. And as we know, both Wembley Stadium, but particularly the O2 Arena, can deliver that.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen a couple of shows in Hyde Park. I saw Roger Waters and Nick Mason doing Dark Side of the Moon, supported by Texas. And Chris Difford, funnily enough, there's a lineup to conjure with.
That's a very peculiar lineup.
It was a peculiar lineup, yeah. And that was pretty good. It was, I don't know if it was undersubscribed, but it certainly didn't seem to be the hordes that had turned out for Springsteen at the weekend. The sound seemed pretty okay. It was the middle of summer, so it stayed daylight till quite late on, and the weather was superb. And if anything, it was too hot. I think it touched on 90 in the middle of the afternoon. And that seemed to go quite well, and quite sensibly, they laid on chilled water that was sort of on taps into troughs, and you could like run your head under the chilled water, and it was drinkable as well. That seemed like a very good idea. So that was a really enjoyable event. I really liked that. But maybe a year later, I went back to see the Simon and Garfunkel reunion.
Oh, yes.
In Hyde Park. And had high hopes of it, as I'd enjoyed the Pink Floyd thing so much. That was a different kettle of fish. As you couldn't get within, what seemed like a kilometre of the stage, because there was priority seating from the stage reaching back, you know, God knows how far. You couldn't go any further on an ordinary ticket. You really felt like, you know, you were just on the top of a ladder watching it over the wall, to be perfectly honest. They had the big, jumbotron screens, but you kind of feel like you're at least somewhere in the region of the stage. And I really didn't feel that we were. Plus, Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel clearly hadn't really made it up. They'd only shaken hands over a check. So the atmosphere was sorely lacking, to be honest. And I was a bit disastrous, really. I'm glad to say I've seen Simon and Garfunkel, but I couldn't really recall anything amazing from that night. So, fortunately,
mainly for me, it's been my history goes back to the free gigs. They were all free in those.
Yeah.
The one that I was talking about going to in 1971 was free. They were all free, and I went in 74. I was booking agent for a band who were reasonably well known at the time called GT Moore and the Reggae Guitar, so we're right at the bottom of the bill, and I went along on that one. And then a little bit of name dropping coming up the following year, 75, we had another artist on the bill called Shusha, who actually, funnily enough, was the paramour of GT Moore of GT Moore and the Reggae Guitar. So it's a strange coincidence. She's no longer with us, by the way, but accompanying me on that day was none other than Woody Meller from the 101.
Oh, yes.
Who would later, a year or so later, would become Joe Strummer of The Clash. But the strangest one, the strangest I think one of the last free ones that I think was held at Hyde Park, 1976, September 76. Here's a strange lineup, if I may put before you. Bottom of the bill, opening. By the way, all these gigs, they used to be over by about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, so there was no question then of any late night curfews or...
Well, maybe that's the solution, you know.
That's the solution, to have it all over in an afternoon. Bottom of the bill, Steve Hillage.
Yeah.
The sort of hippie, mumbling, psychedelic
film. Yeah, yeah.
Then next up on the bill was Supercharged. Now, nobody would know of them now, but they were sort of really good kind of rock funk band who did a lot of festivals at the time. They came over really well on the live stage. Then, bearing in mind, we've just had Steve Hillage and Supercharged. Second topping the bill, Kiki D.
Ah.
Unusual choice. And then top of the bill, Queen, who... Oh, again, my lack of affection for Queen is well known. Again, I just had links at the time, management and so on, with Kiki D, that's why we were there. And, very rarely do I walk away from a gig, but Queen was just unbearable. So that was my experience, one of my last experiences, and probably, I'm guessing, one of the last overall experiences of these free gigs in Hyde Park. But they, of course, being free, unlike the 35,000 we had for Springsteen, I mean, 100,000 would not be unknown.
No, no.
The place was absolutely rammed.
So how were these shows finance then? Who was paying for the PA and the artist fees and the road crew and everything? Eh?
That's a very good question, and I don't know the answer. I imagine it must have been just it was just a promotional device.
Yeah.
That, you know, if you appeared, in other words, it would be an investment. I think it was Black Hill Enterprises, who were, I think, the people behind the management of Pink Floyd for quite some time.
Uh-huh.
And they always seemed to be the promoters. So I imagine that perhaps the record companies paid for their artists to appear or cover the costs as a sort of promotional tool. Again, you've got to remember, back in those days, you know, we didn't have the sort of MTV and the multiple television channels. This would often be the only chance that people would get to go and see a range of bands that they've maybe heard of, but had no idea what they were like live, or even probably what they looked like.
No, sure, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Now, so that was our reflection on the events of the last week, which had several people trapped in the mud, disgruntledly watching Bruce Springsteen or Madonna or Paul Simon. I'm going to bring to your attention an opinion poll.
Oh.
And now, yes, I always was sceptical about opinion polls, which go back to my days of working in radio, and we used to say things like, well, vote for your top single of the year. And that when we used to say, and 1,200 people have voted for this, it actually meant 12 people, which kind of, you know, multiplied the figures somewhat. Now, I'm not saying... Of course, I'm not saying that the Lucky Voice karaoke website has done anything of that nature, but they have revealed the top five in their poll of allegedly 100,000 music fans.
Yes.
And what they asked people was, what's the top songs that make you feel proud to be British?
Oh, right, okay.
And unusually, I'm going to count down from 1 to 5, okay, because the number 5 is a song that a tune that you wish to talk about. So I'm going to go down from 1 to 5. But pretty much each of these made me squirm in my seat, because if this is what makes people proud to be British, then we're in big trouble. Number 1. Queen, We Are the Champions. That makes the most people proud to be British when they hear.
Absolutely dreadful record.
Dreadful record. Followed at number 2, with 11,000 votes, they say, Oasis and Wonderwall. How on earth that can make you feel proud to be British again?
Even Noel Gallagher doesn't quite know what it means. So
yes. Number 3, Let It Be by the Beatles.
Right.
Which is, you know, a song largely written by Paul McCartney about his mother.
Mm.
Why that would make him, I don't know. Number 4, Elton John's Candle in the Wind.
Okay.
I'm guessing that's linked to the Princess of Wales and the adaptation of that song.
Yep.
But number 4, sure, in the Lucky Voice karaoke website, I've never heard of them either, don't worry, Number five, in the songs that make people proud to be British, none than the aforementioned Clash and London Calling.
Right, okay. Well, it has got the name of the capital city in it. So it does, I mean, without wishing to point the finger at any karaoke website, I'm sure they're all fine, robust organisations. I just wonder if the Office Junior hadn't been asked to scribble five songs down that have got something to do with Britain, that you might not get the same result. But
you may say that I could possibly endorse such a scandalous view.
No, of course the parish poll, which runs on the homepage of the Rocking Vicar every week, is the absolute authority on polling, yes, and market research, and is the exception to the rule. Okay, well, so London Calling, right. I mean, like I say, by dint of the fact that it's got the name of the capital in its title, I suppose we could have had London Town by Wings, couldn't we? Or The Streets of London by Ralph McTell, or any of those. But London Calling it was. Well, the reason London Calling crossed my radar this week, aside from the fact that I just sort of kind of lived my life around the Clash, but particularly came onto the horizon this week, was that British Airways have forked out to use it on their, well, it's kind of their Olympic campaign, isn't it? Persuading. It's interesting it's running in the UK, because I can't imagine how anybody in the UK would need to catch a British Airways flight to attend the Olympics. But anyway, that seems to be the gist. It seems to be the gist of it.
You make a fair point.
Yeah. But aside from that, initially I got all sort of red in the face and indignant that the finest rock and roll band ever to stomp the face of the earth had been purloined to advertise an airline which is, well, hardly the pride of Britain these days, is it really? It's always in financial difficulties. It seems to treat its customers quite poorly. And there's also in the past been embroiled in dirty tricks campaigns and all sorts of stuff. The affection for British Airways is not what it once was. And so wedging the wonderful, earth-shatteringly great record that London Calling is with this marketing campaign for an airline, at first made me rather cross, but then I stopped and considered, and I thought, does it really matter? Very many adverts that you see these days have a song attached to it. Sometimes it's a song that you care little for. Other times it's a rather terrific song that you like quite a lot. Does it matter that it's attached to an advert? Not really, does it? Because, you know, music is written and it's put out there and it has a value and it has earning potential. And unless you're crass, and I don't mean, you know, that as an adjective, unless you're the band Crass, then presumably you expect the music that you've put out there, whatever, you know, the meaning and the sentiment and the lyrics, you expect that song to go out there and earn its living for you. And, yeah, this is presumably what's happening with London Calling. Somebody associated with the Clash, obviously not Joe, but somebody associated with the Clash would have had to have signed that off. And certainly Mick and Paul and Topper would be, you know, happy for the income to pay their mortgages, feed their children, and they replace the sofa or whatever it is. And they're not in some sort of Peter Green style tearing those checks up, are they? So
no, or burning them like the Chinese funeral.
The Chinese funeral
attendees.
And if it means that Mick Jones' family get to have an exotic holiday this summer, I'm glad of it. You know, they did the work. They created the song. It's a song that resonates with a lot of people. Otherwise, British Airways wouldn't be using it, and therefore it benefits the guys who wrote it and recorded it. And so I calmed down a great deal and thought, no, I'm only getting out of my pram here because it's a record that means so much to me. And some advertising agency somewhere and some airline are treating it with disrespect. But then I figure that, you know, if it was that disrespectful, then the musicians involved wouldn't have had a bar of it, and they clearly have. And like I say, if it benefits Paul, Topper and Mick and their families, then I'm delighted for them.
I'll tell you what troubles me about that commercial, if I may.
Yeah, of course.
It's not the use of London Calling. No. It's the fact that the one place I don't want to see an aeroplane is on the street. And, you know, I like, if I'm going to be travelling on an aeroplane, because this commercial, if you haven't seen it, by presumably camera trickery, shows a British Airways airplane negotiating the streets of London. And that's not where I want to imagine an aeroplane to be. I want an aeroplane to either be on a runway or many thousands of feet up in the air. Mm. And so it's something a little bit troubling to me when I saw this aeroplane sort of floating along the streets of London.
Well,
that was a bit that troubled
me. Low-flying aircraft in the streets of a large city is not an image that we relish post 2001, is it, really?
Exactly not. So that's the bit that immediately struck me, that it was somewhat disorientating. And if I was boarding a plane tomorrow, that's not the image that I would want in my mind of an aeroplane negotiating the streets of Whitehall. I wanted up in the air and then landing safely and securely on the runway.
Maybe it was supposed to be negotiating the environment of the Olympic Stadium, but the G4S wouldn't let them in.
No, and the sat-nav let them down and they got lost en route, several of the buses did earlier this week.
It's not a great advert, but I've kind of got over myself and the fact that they're using the Clash, because...
Still makes you sit up, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If you're just sitting at home and you're just looking out the window or reading a book or something and you've got the TV on in the background and suddenly those strident chords come in, it still makes you jump up, doesn't it?
Yeah, you wonder why that is appearing on the TV. But I suppose we've got a bear in mind that, you know, there are lots of people out there for whom, for instance, Motown is the most wonderful music they've ever heard. Mm. And, you know, for years they've tolerated the Supremes and the Vandellas and the Four Tops being used on commercials over and over again. And we haven't objected to that. So it's all relative to what, you know, the precious music is for you. I would have actually been incandescent and not got over myself if they'd in any way re-recorded and re-lyriced it. So that would have been... But just
What do you make of the Buzzcocks in the car thing? Ever fallen in love with someone you shouldn't have fallen in love with? Played by some youngsters in a Ford. Is it a Ford? It's a Kia. Isn't it?
I think it's a Kia. Yeah. Oh crikey! You know, there's a huge burden one has to carry through one's life having forged a career in advertising.
Yes.
Because it's very hard for me to point my finger at the advertising industry and mock it or deride it in any sort of way, because that's the industry in which I've worked for nearly 20 years on and off and in various guises. But I think in this funny sort of way, I'm better placed to point out bad ads than other people, perhaps. And this is a terrible ad. Yeah, you're right. It's for anybody who hasn't seen it, it features an enormous inverted commas, a young rock band in a tiny little car on the way to a gig, trying to get a cover of Ever Falling in Love with Someone You Shouldn't Have Fallen in Love With, together in time for playing it at this live concert. It shows a spectacular misunderstanding of how concerts are organised and how bands...
Let's do the show right
...put their
here.
Material together. That seems to have been completely overlooked. And just everything about it just reeks of appalling artifice, and some ad executive and or copywriter's concept of how to attach a level of cool to one's brand. There's nothing particularly cool about small, inconspicuous cars. And so the way they've attempted to flog the car is to suggest that it's the vehicle of choice for young, trendy rock bands with blonde supermodels as lead singers. And none of this is true, and they're not a band, and the gig that we see at the end isn't a gig, and nothing about it is true, and no portion of cool has been applied to the brand. So it's a disaster from beginning to end. There you go. You lay that at the door of the advertising agency. And if Pete Shelley gets a holiday in the Bahamas out of it, then it's not all been bad, has it?
Well, talking about music on TV, we agreed this week that we would watch a programme that's been running for several months, not a year now, but I kind of dip into and dip out of, which is this the running of all episodes of Top of the Pops from 1976 onwards every week on BBC4. And in our different parts of the country this week, we tuned in to watch Top of the Pops 1977. With Jimmy Savile, already looking something of a relic, even in 1977. And it struck me in a show that was completely devoid of any actor at all. The countdown at the start, the top 30 countdown, which again seemed to me missing a trick altogether by putting it at the beginning. First act on really amused me because it was Dave Edmonds miming to I Knew the Bride When She Used to Rock and Roll.
Yeah, Rock Pile, wasn't it?
That's right. With Nick Lowe on bass.
Nick Lowe on bass, yeah. And Dave Edmonds with long hair, which I never realised that Dave Edmonds sported collar-length hair.
Just what I was going to say, because he had this shoulder-length hair, as most men did during the golden year of punk.
That's absolutely right. But I always, I mean, you say Dave Edmonds and you see him with a gingery blonde quiff, don't you, without fail. You know, so I never realised, I thought he was born with a gingery blonde quiff.
No, he was one of the long hair hippie brigade
Nick Lowe wore his hair long, perhaps before, just, you know, so we started producing The Damned or maybe beyond, but Dave Edmonds took me by surprise, really. It looked like Dave Edmonds going to a 70s fancy dress party.
Well, then we had next up on the bill was this bloke who I must admit I'd completely forgotten about, Tony Ettoria, who was proving really that funky tracks never work on TV, and especially Top of the Pops. Performers generally look kind of mildly embarrassed and unsure what to do with themselves, especially their hands and their legs. They don't know what to do. And if there's an instrumental middle eight, by the way, they simply squirm there on stage as this Tony Ettoria bloke did. We still had the Ladybirds providing backing vocals to the acts at this time, which is absolutely wonderful. These three very square-looking ladies who sort of provided the backing from everybody, you know, from Dave Edmonds through Engelbert Humperdinck, through to the Stranglers or whoever. But then, who came up next? It was Gary Glitter.
Yeah.
Miming terribly, absolutely terribly. And did you notice he's backed by some blokes in evening dress?
Yes,
it's astonishing. 1977, the golden era of punk, Gary Glitter and a backing band of evening dress. And in light of subsequent events, of course, almost every line of the lyric that he sang made me wince.
Exactly, you know? You can't perceive Gary Glitter in the way you once did, can you? Ever again now.
It's everything is
laden with the dark secrets that was eventually revealed. But this must have been, it was a song called A Little Boogie Woogie in the Back of My Mind, which is hardly the first song that springs up when you think of Gary Glitter. No. You know, it's not rock and roll or The Leader, is it really? So it's like he did this, and clearly it was after the point where the Glitter Band broke off and figured they could have a go without him. So he was, as you say, lumbered with these guys who looked like they were from Butlins in Rill, a show band from some Whalian holiday camp, you know. So,
unfortunate bald drummer. Now, there's nothing wrong with going bald, but this particular bloke, it did lend the air, as you say, of a kind of out-of-season holiday camp.
Yeah, well, as we now know, Glitter was bald as well.
Oh, of course, as the proverbial coot, and indeed shoehorned in to this kind of faux leather outfit that he was wearing, rather like the Elvis comeback era of 1968. This was Gary Glitter, kind of, you could see almost, he must have been oiled into this tight-fitting leather jumpsuit.
Yes, but this was the thing with Glitter, wasn't it, that even in his prime, you know, when he was young and enormously popular and had the Glitter Band backing him, he was always a bit clunky, a bit matronly, wasn't he? You stand him next to Bolan and he never exuded that supernatural cool of his contemporaries, did he?
He had the air of a bricklayer.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he was a bricklayer in eyeliner, wasn't he? You know, and, he never had that absolutely compelling charisma that Bolan or Bowie or Ferry had at the time, did he? He was always, he had the record sales, but he was a bit of an also-ran in the coolness stakes, wasn't he? He even at his height.
And I think even when he was having those hits with, as you said, rock and roll and whatever the hell else I've forgotten now, but he was already about 30 yeah. then, you know, because he'd been around way in the early 60s.
Paul Gadd. And then he was Paul Raven, wasn't he?
And Paul Raven, a couple of careers before, rather like Alvin Stardust as well, who followed in his path, had been known as Shane Fenton back in the early 60s. Shane Fenton and the Fentons, and as you say, Paul Gadd, Paul Raven.
Just down the road from me, there, Shane Fenton was from Mansfield.
Yeah. So these people were already in their late 20s, to be generous, probably early 30s. Did you notice that, as usual, the young audience spent the whole show looking at themselves on the studio monitors instead of at the act?
Yeah.
That was something that I found very plain. And there was a marvellous moment. The whole programme was worth watching because some unknown disc jockey with receding hair and probably with the word wacky somewhere in his name, popped up to introduce an absolutely soulless performance from Brotherhood of Man. And I'd forgotten how hard they tried to be a sort of British ABBA-like.
Oh, didn't they? I mean, obviously the management, having won the Eurovision Song Contest with Save All Your Kisses, the management thought, hold on, well, look what happened to ABBA. You know, that was just the start of this gargantuan career, and they figured that it would be thus for the Brotherhood of Man. And they were Econo ABBA all over, weren't they? Yeah,
they really were. Yeah. They were the Lidl ABBA. Really were. Where ABBA had Fernando, Brotherhood of Man had Angela. God Almighty! I mean, I think the show underlined just how dreadful pop music was in the mid 70s.
Yeah, falling. Yeah,
and I'm really sorry about this, punk people, but the Stranglers came on, and you know, I thought, oh, the Stranglers, and of course they were miming, of course, Go Buddy Go, and they looked so distinctly non-threatening, and they sounded so remarkably tinny that I found there was little to differentiate between them and the Brotherhood of Man, who'd been on 2 minutes
there's
earlier.
A story behind this Stranglers appearance on Top of the Pops. They were actually in the charts with Peaches.
Peaches, a tremendous
record, I think. But it is riddled with references to parts of the female body, and the S word crops up as well.
Yes, it does.
And it was deemed altogether way beyond the taste boundaries set by the BBC at the time. Although I believe you can hear Peaches on daytime radio too now, but back then it was way beyond anything that was acceptable. And they were invited to re-record Peaches with the biological and the scatological references taken out, which they flatly refused, but they came up with the compromise that they would appear doing the B-side, which was Go Buddy Go, which I think Jean-Jacques Burnel wrote when he was 14 or something. But,
That doesn't surprise me. It sounded it.
Yeah,
I thought
it's not a great record. It's not a punk record by any stretch of the imagination. And so they did that, and so that's a vague anecdote behind it. But I did notice in a sort of rather pathetic attempt to reveal the artifice of miming on Top of the Pops, they'd swapped instruments. Hugh Cornwall was playing lead on a bass, and Jean-Jacques Burnel was playing bass on a lead. And he...
Oh, such anarchy.
Yeah, anarchy exactly. In the UK. And so that's the Jet Black looked like he couldn't wait to get back to the off licence, which he was running at the time. So, and
that's right. And talking of age, not that it shouldn't have, because he was already about 40.
60,
in 1977, yes.
Yeah, he's really the grand old man of rock. Still in the Stranglers, still drumming in the Stranglers, which I'm pleased
And into
to
his
see.
70s,
he
I
is
think.
Is yeah, brilliant.
Mid-late 70s,
absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. So, yeah, so that was, I mean, and that was the sole... recognition of the new wave on the entire programme, wasn't it?
It really was. And again, the sort of strange jump, as I said, from Brotherhood of Man to the Stranglers, we then jumped to Johnny Nash.
Yes.
And he was got huge lapels on his shirt. But to be fair, a gorgeous voice with a song I'd completely forgotten.
When Savile said Johnny Nash, I thought, it's going to be I Can See Clearly.
But it wasn't. To say he stole the show, though, I thought was an understatement, because I thought he was the only highlight. I thought his voice was just immaculate. But then, oh no, we'd had Gary Glitter, but then, oh no, here comes Legs and Co.
Yes.
Dancing to the Alessi Brothers' rather wonderful Lorry.
Lorry, yeah.
And, I mean, in that sort of pre-video age, we sort of came to accept, didn't we, these kind of variety hall style dancing girl routines, yeah, where they generally literally interpreted the lyrics, yeah, of whatever record they were invited to prance about to. And my only surprise was that they didn't come on a lorry. <You know>? Oh, lorry, and then they come in a truck.
That would have been great, though, you know? That would have been...
That would have been quite amusing.
I would have watched that over and over if they'd come in on a lorry. That would have been fantastic. No, the Legs and Co thing. Were they Legs and Co by the... They weren't pants people.
They were Legs and Co. No, they were Legs and Co at this point. I looked at the credits.
Okay, they were Legs and Co. But it was a distraction for the dads, wasn't it? It was so the dads didn't switch over because they couldn't stand any more pop music. That was...
Fair point. That may well have been.
Yeah, it was the page three of early evening BBC One, wasn't it? It was like here's the girls, you know, here's the dancing.
Absolutely
girls.
Dreadful show. I mean, produced by Robin Nash. The bow tie wearing Robin Nash, who sort of also controlled the Radio One playlist. And I mean, he and Doreen Davis, who sort of controlled all the music on the BBC at the time, you know, absolutely so out of date and out of time.
Absolutely.
That, when we look back now, absolute disgrace that these people were able to dictate what people would hear on their radio and TV, which included second top of the bill. Oh my goodness, if you can get a chance to see this on iPlayer, just fast forward it to this bit because it will make you want to put your boot through the television. Paul Nicholas, Heaven on the Seventh Floor.
Yes, it was a very, very dodgy lyric, I thought. I mean,
it was.
It really showed how, the values and principles and the realms of acceptability have shifted, whereas, you could now play Go Buddy Go or Peaches on daytime radio now, no problem at all. You would have trouble putting on Paul Nicholas singing about this.
his fleeting relationship that he had with somebody in a lift when the elevator stopped on the seventh floor.
Aerosmith did something similar with Love in an Elevator. Yes, however, the lyric of this, to me, and perhaps it's just, my dreadful mind, but seems to suggest that he'd forced himself on this young lady, because the first verse was about her saying, turning him down for a date and saying, I'm not interested in you, I don't like you at all. They get in a lift and get stuck. And then it's like she's got no choice.
Oh, crikey. I didn't pick up on that. I shall have to look at that later. But what I felt with Paul Nicholas, though, is that no performer had more awareness of which camera was live. He knew exactly every camera angle, but yet no performer on the show was more punchable than Paul Nicholas.
I believe this is what they call in the business mugging, isn't it?
Oh, he was mugging away. And speaking of which... Coming to mugging, we finally had a hugely embarrassed Peter Frampton wheeled on. The poor fellow, he absolutely, you can see in his eyes, that his brain ticking away, saying, what am I doing here? Yeah. But anyway, he was there to introduce the number one, which was the Jacksons' Let Me Show You, which was a filmed US performance, and really only came alive when the camera picked up on Michael. I don't know if you noticed that it was dreary until Michael came.
Oh, I think that, I mean, that stole the show for me, I think. I think, having seen the Paul Nicholas and... all the other rather ropey performers that were there, that this was, suddenly went to another level of professionalism and glamour and charisma. And, the Jacksons in the 70s were fairly, unimpeachable. They were absolutely, tremendous. And, like you say, interestingly enough, a taped performance. So we'd gone through all that to find out who was there in the studio to do the number one single. And they were, clearly at home in Los Angeles at the time. So, we didn't get them in the studio, but it did put the others to shame. I thought the Jacksons' performance.
Oh, so
I thought that was very impressive. And, they seemed to be singing live, albeit on film, but they seemed to be performing live in extreme.
Yes.
Making an extremely good job of it as well. But the whole program is... there's an interesting phenomenon where you remember the programs that you saw at a certain period in your life as being much more professional than they actually were. And presumably we'll look back on shows we're watching now and think, God, I thought they were so cutting edge and so well produced, and they weren't. Because... this was a case in point, but I also saw an episode of The Professionals a couple of weeks ago and had memories of The Professionals, Lewis Collins, Martin Shaw, being very gritty, very dynamic, very action-packed, very exciting. And, you know, you watch them now, they really weren't. They were really sort of turgid and laboured and terribly badly acted. And I guess when I saw that episode of Top of the Pops back in 77, which I almost certainly did, I would have thought, you know, it's because that's the state of the art, isn't it? I would have thought, you know, this is great. This is a music show. Yeah, terrific. How great. Looking back now, it looks like it was made in a sixth form common room by, you know, somebody who picked up a camera 10 minutes before it rolled. It's so amateurish. It's unbelievable.
It was, yeah. Wasn't it? I share your view exactly. We didn't pick up on that at the time. It's what we had.
Yeah.
And it was what it was.
Yeah, it didn't get better than that. So.
No, yeah. Absolutely not.
And even Savile, who has, you know, prior to his death, promoted himself as being, you know, the ultimate pro disc jockey, who at one point he was claiming he invented disc jockeying. And even he was very uncomfortable, didn't really have his links prepped at all.
At one point,
crashed the vocal, which you think they could have sorted out in the edits, but he talked all over the opening vocal of the song and seemed to figure that as the camera panned away from him, there was an instruction from the gallery to dance a bit and indicated that he had no ability to dance if his life depended on it. No.
And I kind of suspect, and I don't think I'd be wrong in this, that he actually probably had absolutely no idea about any of the acts who were on there. Probably had never heard of them, probably hadn't heard their records.
No.
Had been given a running order and had just about managed to memorize the name of the artist and the song.
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't a musical innovator, was he? You know, never championed a band in his life, did he? So.
No, not at all. I don't think he had hardly any interest in that at all.
No.
As I said right at the beginning when we were talking about this, he looked, you know, not that there's anything wrong with being old, but he looked like a very old man then.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And of course, it's yet another sort of 30 years or so before he would in fact leave us. So
absolutely. He did look like an old man. You can incidentally buy his Rolls Royce this week if you fancy it.
I'll swerve that.
Interestingly enough, the showroom from which he bought it in 1973, I think, so he made his money pretty quickly. And he had it customised as well. He had the Silver Lady plated gold. Good grief.
Oh, he would.
Yes, he would indeed.
Yeah.
And bought it and left it in the showroom for 6 weeks and then came round once to drive it to the shops and brought it back to the showroom. It's all very odd. Anyway, the showroom is still going, I'm pleased to say, that up there in Leeds, and they are reselling it now, yeah.
I last known it because we're running very late, but I just wanted to ask if you noticed, it was a bit that unnerved me. I think it was quite near the end when he was saying goodbye, when he had some poor young teenage girl in a kind of on camera. I just thought that was quite unnerving.
He always sort of his shtick on Top of the Pops was to surround himself with a bevy of young ladies, and quite why this week he decided to put a martial arts hold on the girl. I really don't know. I'm sure she wasn't a willing volunteer, that's for sure.
No, it didn't look like she was at all. It was a bit troubling. Now, last week we talked about, reviewed, if you wish, a programme on Channel 4 called The Bank of Dave.
Yeah.
And we thought, as it was a two-parter, it would only be fair to just quickly come back and have a look at the second part. And I would particularly keen to see whether you still had such enthusiasm for Dave as you did in the first week. This is a programme on Channel 4 on Thursday, and talk about things troubling you. It opened with the voiceover man saying, talking about Dave, paperwork isn't Dave's strong point. Which I thought, now that's a bit of a problem if you're actually trying to open a bank, you know. But anyway, we saw him handing out loans this week, £1,200 for a riding stable, £400 for a car park, £75,000 for an outdoor adventure company. Bit odd, we saw Dave in Las Vegas for about 10 seconds, and then suddenly he was in Wall Street in New York playing the stock market and so on and so forth. He basically was there to see how much he could make on a £100,000 fund that he was putting in, and he made 3.2% in one day on the stock market to sort of prove that he could do better than British banks. Were you as keen on the Bank of Dave and Dave Fishwick after part two, Magnus Shaw?
Yeah, I love Dave Fishwick. He comes very close to the line where you'd say, right, he's annoying me now, but he never quite crosses it because he really is genuine. It's not a sort of character he's created. I really think that Dave Fishwick is as you see him, and he just seems like a really warm, open-hearted guy whose ideas are coming from the right place. And perhaps much to everybody's surprise, at the end of this episode, it kind of worked. He kind of given large checks to many local charities, which, interestingly enough, rather than transferring it into their account, he walked into the charity shops where you go and get an old jumper or a sort of second-hand paperback and said, can I write you a check? Which is fair enough.
Oh, that's a check, yeah.
It's fairly unorthodox, but it worked. You know, his first round of loans had realised some capital, which he'd done as he said he would do, and split that profits between local charities, and so I'm really glad it worked for him. I suspect, if I was being deeply cynical, this is not a model that is going to catch fire, and we're going to have Banks of Dave's, or Bank on Dave, as he has to call it, yes, spread across the country. I think it's a bit of a novelty, but it's a novelty with a purpose. It's obviously proved the point he wanted to make, and he's delighted to have done it, and it's benefiting people. So I think, everyone's a winner in this, and if it shames the banks in any small way, then presumably the majority of people are going to be in favour of that as well. So good on Dave. My opinion hasn't changed. I think he's a smashing fella, and if you ever fancies a pot of tea in Derbyshire, he's very welcome at my house.
And, of course, Vince Cable popped up to offer his support, which I wondered, would that have happened without the Channel 4 cameras present?
But No.
But anyway, we'll leave Dave because to a soundtrack of Danny Wilson's Mary's Prayer, we saw Dave sweeping through the streets of Burnley, the best town in the world, he said. So
that's not true.
we'll leave Dave to it with time pressing against us. Fine Stripe Productions for Channel 4, available on 4OD if you want to see that. Time, Magnus Shaw, to turn yet again to your pretend iPod.
Mine. I like the way it's mine.
It's your iPod. Although I'm warming to it. I am warming to it. Now that we've got 50-plus tracks on it, I do occasionally
50 weeks into stop. It. He likes it.
A year later, yeah. I'm
and this is, to it. Because this is people power, because under no inconsiderable pressure, it was pulled at one point, and the pressure was flowing one way. And then listener power brought it back, and there you go. Or never listen to your compadre. I always listen to the listener.
I concede the point. Mr. Speaker, sir. In 1972-73, it's accepted wisdom that most teenage girls were enthralled to David Cassidy or the Osmonds. But in my world, most girls in the college common room wore badges proclaiming their devotion to Gilbert O'Sullivan.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Whilst the more sophisticated girls were fans of Clifford T. Ward and Colin Bluntstone.
Yes, yes.
Now, you could never be a pop star in 2012 with a name like Colin Bluntstone. Some 14-year-old at the record company would urge a change of name to Professor B or Plan C or something like that. Colin Bluntstone, he sounds like a cricketer from the 1960s.
Yeah, he does.
Opening the batting deck today for Yorkshire, Geoffrey Boycott and Colin Bluntstone.
Yes, he'd probably go on to the sports minister after he retired,
wouldn't he? Absolutely, he would, yes, and now be Sir Colin Bluntstone. no doubt. Colin Dunstone had an unusual career. Pop star in the 1960s with the Zombies, with their single She's Not There, and they then recorded the innovative but career-ending album of sort of psychedelic pop, Odyssey and Oracle. The Zombies folded, and Colin Dunstone became an insurance salesman.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. You know, pop stars had to do in those days. What else were they going to do then? No fantastic royalties coming in at the time. He went off to sell insurance. He bounced back into the music business, and in the early 1970s, he recorded this absolutely wonderful trilogy, simply great singles, three great singles. Two of them were I Don't Believe in Miracles and How Could We Dare to Be Wrong, both radio-friendly, gorgeous, breathy, emotive pop. But the first of this trilogy was the Denny Lane-written Say You Don't Mind. And this song has everything. It's got a perky melody, amusing lyrics, stylish orchestration, and its USP for me, its unique selling point for me, is the very last note that Colin Dunstone sings. It's beyond the reach of us mere humans. And I've never managed it in decades, Magnus, of in-car sing-alongs.
Well, that doesn't surprise me.
That note is just beyond me. I'm determined that I'll get there one day, but I haven't managed it yet. You can hear it in the clip at the end of this podcast, or you can hear it on the iPod, pretend iPod on the website, or on the Spotify playlist of the iPod. Number 15 in the UK Top 40 in January 1972, Say You Don't Mind, Colin Dunstone.
Yeah, always crops up on these guilty pleasure compilations, doesn't it? As if there's something wrong with liking it. I don't know why that should be. It's really... It's a unique record, isn't it? I can't think of another record that sounds quite like it. It's very sparse and minimalist, isn't it? And there's an organ, a keyboard sound, really, that backs the whole thing. There might be... Is there drumming on it? If there is, I don't... It doesn't stand out to me. And instantly recognisable. I think certainly everybody of our generation knows it extremely well. Made from airplay, more than actually owning a copy, I would imagine. But...
Absolute classic. Certainly in my top 20 of all time. Might even sneak it into my top 10.
Oh, okay. Wow.
I rate it that
high. High praise indeed. Well, jolly good. And we shall recall it all over again when it appears on those formats that you just mentioned. So my pick this week. Now, I might profess to be an expert in all sorts of things and would probably be wrong, but I certainly don't profess to be an expert in Northern Soul. And it's certainly one of those brands of music where there are many experts. I mean, I think there are people who... know everything about Northern Soul and nothing about any other brand of music. It attracts that kind of devotion, doesn't it? It's almost like a religion for some people. I'm not one of those people. However, the Northern Soul tracks that I do know of, I really, really like. Of course, very few people went into the studio and said, you know, I'm a Northern Soul act. I'm going to record a Northern Soul song. What tended to happen was that reasonably obscure American artists would put out reasonably obscure soul records and they would be adopted by the Northern Soul faithful. So records that were recorded in studios in San Francisco, Las Vegas, New York, would find their audience in steamy, sweaty, and very downbeat halls around the north of England, which is an extraordinary phenomenon and one that I've always found very attractive. So the idea of music finding a welcome so many miles from its origins. But anyway, as I say, the Northern Soul records that I like a lot, I really like a lot, songs like the original Tainted Love, Gloria Jones, and Do I Love You, Indeed I Do is a phenomenal record. But my absolutely favourite Northern Soul record is by a gentleman called Al Wilson, and it's a song called The Snake. Didn't know, still perhaps don't know that much about Al Wilson, but he was, as is the tradition with Northern Soul, reasonably obscure American soul singer, was still with us until 2008. His real name was Alan Lamar Wilson, which, just going back to your thing about naming artists, these days he'd be called Al Lamar, wouldn't he? But it's the Lamar that he dropped and opted for Al Wilson. Had really only two big hits. An American number one, actually, a million seller Show and Tell. That's not the one I picked, and I don't know that one as well as this one, which is The Snake. The reason I like it so much, I think, is it's damn good fun. There's so much music out there that, albeit magnificent, isn't much fun. This is a really, really good fun record with a really sort of sarcastic and cynical lyric underpinning it. The snake is a metaphor, not for what you might be thinking, incidentally. It's just a metaphor for how badly men treat women. It's a little fairy tale about a woman who takes in a sick snake she finds. And, of course, once she's nursing back to health, the snake bites her, poisons her, and she dies, which is... having claimed it's fun, it might not sound that much fun, but it is, because it's very cheeky, and it's backed by this horn-driven, drum-rolling, rollicking dance theme that you can't resist. I mean, if this came on in Mr. Decom's car, he would not only sing along to it, he'd have to pull over and dance on the roof, because it really is. You talk about, you know, your feet can't sit still. You listen to The Snake, your feet can't sit still. Fantastic slab of Northern Soul, the best Northern Soul record I've heard. And like I say, I probably haven't heard enough, but of what I've heard so far, this is my favourite. With that absolutely biting, quite literally biting lyric to go with it. Al Wilson, The Snake. If you haven't heard it, jump to the website now and give it a play. And if you're not dancing by the end of it, then you have no business listening to any kind of music at all.
I've got to love a bit of Northern Soul.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Have you got a favourite Northern Soul track? Would you pick a Northern Soul track?
Oh, I need more notice. I'll come back to that.
We'll allocate you skiing in the snow for now, and see how you go from there. But yeah, perhaps we need to brush up on our Northern Soul, because we obviously both like it and don't know anything like enough about it. But anyway, there's my pick, Al Wilson, The Snake. And unless you have anything to add, sir, there is no further business. You are summarily dismissed.
Absolutely.
Oh,
I would just say, right, left, and center.
I would just say the Chinese currency is a yuan.
Ah,
perhaps not pronounced by that, but yuan is the Chinese currency that we were struggling with earlier. So thanks very much for listening at home. Thanks very much to Terence for popping in and doing his thing all over. And of course, we will be back in 7 days when we will relish your company once more. See you then. Bye bye.
Gets you so bad that a doormat sees better times. That's the time to get back and think up some better line. I've been doing some growing, but I'm scared where you're going. So say you don't mind, you let me off this time. Let me off this time. I saved you, cried that a woman, and you bit me even a while, and you know your bite is poisonous, and now I'm gonna die. Oh, shut up, silly woman. Say that a reptile with a grin. Now you knew darn well I was a snake before you brought me in. Please take me in, oh, tender woman. Take me in, for heaven's sake. Take me in, tender woman. Sighed the snake.
You have been listening to a Dacom Shore Media Production.